The guilt motif of Spellbound is more explicit than in a lot of your films. What do you think of that picture?
Well, it was the first attempt at psychiatry in films, you know.
Really?
Actually, you know, it was based on a Francis Beeding book called The House of Dr. Edwards,
yeah,
which was about a madman who takes over a madhouse.
Oh, that's kind of like Caligari. Spellbound was criticized, wasn't it, at the time, for being very superficial in its view of analysis, of psychoanalysis. But wasn't that part of the intention?
Well, it was the first picture attempted in that respect. Ben Hecht was the writer on it, and he was very close to psychoanalysis. He was, very friendly with Zilborg, and we had a woman called May Rom, and whatever went into the film was pretty authentic stuff because it was thoroughly covered by Hecht, who was very keen on it at the time.
Yeah. There really wasn't anything superficial in it. It didn't seem superficial to me. But
no, it didn't seem to me. But whoever criticized it must have been a psychoanalyst to know.
And it probably wasn't.
Well, of course not.
What did the doors opening at their first embrace signify?
I asked Ben Hecht to find it out for me. I said, what is the psychiatric symbol for the beginning of love between two people?
Oh,
and he came back with the doors opening. I said, I want to know what is the correct symbol. Yeah. What is a symbol?
Is that a Freudian?
Apparently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why did you start the picture with Bergman as such a cold person? Was this as a contrast?
Oh, naturally, sure, yeah.
Was she? Do you feel that she was really in love with Peck, or that she was really more interested in him as a patient?
There was an attraction there. I don't know, I wouldn't say that she fell in love completely.
Even by the end?
Not entirely, no.
Doesn't Bergman do some pretty foolhardy things in the picture? I mean, she goes skiing with him, and then she confronts Leo G. Carroll. Is she just stupid, or just brave, or just dedicated?
I'd say she was brave.
Why did you go to Dolly for the dream sequence?
Selznick at the time thought I only wanted Dolly for publicity purposes. That wasn't true. I had felt that if I'm going to have to do dream sequences, they should be vivid.
Mm.
I didn't think that we should resort to the old-fashioned blurred,
blurry
you
screen,
know, blurry age and so forth. As a matter of fact, you know, I felt that the Freud things weren't too good in that respect, you know.
The Houston's film?
Yes.
I didn't see it.
The edges are just what we call Vaseline dissolved.
Around the lens?
Yeah, around the lens, you know. So I said they should be, actually, although they wouldn't do it at the time, they were going to be too expensive. I wanted the dream sequences to be shot on the back lot in the bright sunshine.
Oh, that's marvelous.
So they would have to stop down the camera to such a degree that they would be needle sharp compared with the rest of the picture and was slightly diffused all the way through, because that was the cameraman's particular style. And I wanted these things to be so sharp and vivid that I would prefer to have done them outside. So that was my reason, because of Dali's draftsmanship and the infinity that which he introduces into his subject.
That's very interesting, making it sharper than the rest, as opposed to most people who make it blurrier than the rest.
That's right. No, I wanted the opposite.
Well, dreams actually, in a sense, are sharper than...
Of course, they're very, very vivid. We use the word, don't we? Vivid dream.
Yeah.
A vivid dream is a dream where you where you're sometimes glad to wake up from it, you know?
Yeah.
Would you agree that the point of view shot is one of the keys to your technique?
Entirely. Subjective treatment. which is, to me, the purest form of cinema.
Put the audience
in the mind of the character. That's the purest form of cinema to me, and I suppose Rear Window is the best example of that. Mm. And there you have a close-up.
The whole thing is shown.
Of course, you close-up of a man, what he sees, and how you build up the ideas from the visual, you see. He sees things going on. He reacts to it. And that can't be done in any other medium. Can't be done in the theater. Can't be done in a novel. That's the purest form of cinema, is the subjective treatment.
Yeah. You use it quite often. I remember vividly, particularly, I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but the shot in Spellbound when she's going up the stairs and she sees that letter and you go up with it, you know.
Yes.
to make that's her right. feel what she's
You put the audience in the mind of that particular character. For example, Julie Andrews in the press conference scene in Torn Curtain.
Yes, marvelous. Always so far away from him.
So far away from him, and all through heads. And I creep in as the conference goes on, but always the head's in the foreground. Mm. Never sees him in the clear.
To show an alienation.
Distance. And also... the points where you get both points of view rarely appreciated, but nevertheless emotionally effective, I imagine, in the scene of the security office at the airport before the press conference.
Mm-hmm.
He talks to Newman for a bit about bringing the girl. Shall we have her in, he says. Brought in. Newman's sitting this side of the room, she's sitting that side of the room. Never are they contained in any shop with the rest of the people in the room.
They're over
there. The group are over there.
And they're over there.
The group and Newman and the girl are on their own.
Yes.
They're all photographed. He alone, she alone, the group.
There's a complete alienation between the three parties.
Sure, it's these two with each other. No part of these other people at all.
So you show them in the same frame together and the others...
No, don't show them in the...
That's what I was going
to say. There are three elements.
Three elements.
Newman
right.
alone, the girl alone, the group.
Because they don't know what anybody's thinking and...
They're away, they're with each other. Their thoughts are crossing to each other.
Yeah. This was another question I was going to ask later on. Which was this whole idea of when you show two people in the same frame together, it does imply a union. Whereas if you show them separated, for instance, let's say there's a scene between two people and we're not communicating,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't show that with them in the same frame. You'd cut from their face to his face.
Actually, because if you're shooting them both together, you're being objective
mm-hmm.
and not subjective.
Yes. And you're showing there's an implication to an audience of union, isn't there?
Sure.
When the two people, yeah. Well, this seems to me one of the most important unwritten rules in pictures, and everybody makes that mistake.
Objective shooting is a theater.
Mm.
You see, it's an extension of the theater. You know, I'm not against movies that talk. And they photograph people talking, that's a different kind of movie, but they're not motion pictures.
Mm.
You know, you can have very successful pictures, you know, like Virginia Woolf, it's a theater piece.
Yes.
Got to recognize that fact, acknowledge it, and successful in its own way. I don't go in for that kind of thing. You see, I'm the direct answer. That's why people think I'm a monster,
well,
because I go in for these. You know, the...
Stories?
Yes, who was it? I think Peggy was telling me something about that man McDonald said I was brutal.
Mm. I don't know that. And what do you...
Well, I'm not. I'm just the opposite, you see. I'm a very plastic person. And do not relate in any way to the material I'm handling. Not in any sense at all. For most people... think because you handle thrillers, horror scenes, you know, and I'm laughing up my sleeve all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, could it be extended?
That's why they take themselves seriously. A lot of the, you know, filmmakers who are suspect, especially those who are self-indulgent, you know, they like to cast themselves as painters or poets and. Instead of a movie maker, you know, they're shooting out messages and themes and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
Which is, I think, the work of the literateur or the priest
mm-hmm.
or the parson, I mean, or the politician.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody said there are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who are... We could call them voyeurs, or anyway, people who observe the world that passes by.
and there are people who are active, you know, adventurers who are part of the world. Would you say you were a person who observes?
Observes, sure. Definitely.
So then you must, in a way, identify with Jimmy Stewart's character in Rear Window.
Oh, possibly, yeah, sure. But, you know, that's what I think that the people don't understand. They don't understand professionalism. That the strangling scene is a carefully designed scene, done slowly, meticulously, but comes out like fireworks on the screen.
Right.
You see, if I felt all the same way that Barry Foster feels as a character, but I'd never get it on the screen.
Right.
In other words, idiotic.
In other words, you get no kick out of
at all.
Making a thing like that. Yeah. Well.
No. It's a job to be done.
Mm-hmm. And your intention is to move the audience.
That's right.
Yeah.
I let them scream. Why is it that so many directors are self-indulgent, especially European ones?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that the reason I prefer the directors of your generation is because they approach their work on a professional basis and approach that, well, what John Ford used to say, it's a job of work.
Sure.
And the fact that occasionally from that job of work a piece of art was created, it was not what the man set out to do. In other
well,
words, it was just...
if you take any great artist and look at the canvas before he starts to paint and see all the lines of perspective and composition. You mean if you take a person like Picasso, you know, and he does the double profiles, or he's gone through cubism and God knows what, you see. But he knows every muscle in the human body. If you ask him to draw the figure of a man or a woman, there wouldn't be a muscle out of place.
In other words, he's a man who respects the craft first and then is able to...
Sure. Got to know your craft in order to... there are exceptions, you know.
Do you think of yourself as an artist?
No, not particularly. If you look at Clay's book, which he designed at the Weimar Bauhaus, it's a lecture on lines and where they go and why. He does the squiddling little lines, but they're all analyzed for whatever reason.
Do you have a desire to be remembered? I mean, do you think about posterity?
What did posterity do for me? Isn't that a fair answer?
That's pretty good. Well, I just wondered if you ever, when you, at any point in your career, whether earlier or later or now or then, ever thought of what you were doing as it has been called by many people, great works of art.
They're not, it's not like taking page one of a script and then saying, I will now start a work of art.
Where did you appear in Spellbound, do you remember?
Yes, getting out of an elevator, carrying a violin case, in which was a hard-boiled egg. I had to go purely Freudian in that case.
And
hard-boiled
then,
Freud.
You even brought food into Sherlock Holmes with the breakfast scene with your famous eggs.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You really hate eggs, Hitch?
Oh, I really do. Yeah. It's horrible. I think the smell of a hard-boiled egg is the most horrible thing in the world. How people can eat them. I knew a very big man. He was a producer, theater producer. And we used to have lunch together, and the hors d'oeuvre trolley would go by. And without the trolley stopping, he'd stretch a hand out, pick up a hard-boiled egg, and pop it into his mouth. Oh, really, it was most revolting. Had he
he popped a sardine or something, it might have been different with an egg, you know.
But you don't mind eggs in the souffle or something like that?
No, as long as they're disguised. You know.